The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Then what we can order from catalogs. Anarchists and young male readers everywhere have never quite been the same again. Chuck likes to tell stories that comment on the problems of society. Now, a lot of novels today like to do that, but what sets Chuck's novels apart from the rest is that he's willing to imagine in detail the very strange stories that happen behind the sometimes harsh, sometimes grisly realities of life. In Fight Club, Chuck imagines an underground movement so secret that even the founder had trouble figuring out if it was real. In Survivor, he imagines that it would really, what it would really take to survive a movement that's hell-bent on killing individual identities and lives. In Lullaby, he imagines what it would be like to have the power to kill, and very unusual for this day and age, he imagines a killer who is conscious about being responsible for that power. In Haunted, he imagines why sensible people would be eager to put themselves in dire situations and how that eagerness can kill. And finally, in Rant, Chuck imagines the ultimate conspiracy theory. What if history as we know it is a lie? What if we are all controlled by the idea that we are helpless against time? After all, if the protagonists of Chuck's novels are individuals that defy society in every way possible, as fighters, as scammers, as damaged supermodels, and accidental serial killers, why not defy the logic of time? Chuck once said that what he really wants to do is to tell good stories. Well, here he is tonight, waiting to tell us another good one. And so, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Chuck Palahniuk.
Did Kyle make it into the auditorium tonight? All right. Hey, that's the first reader who ever wrote to me, Kyle McCormick. So thank you, Kyle. And the first thing I want to do tonight is typically the last thing that I do. And because it's the last thing I do, I tend to forget it. So, first off, I would like to thank the Free Library for inviting me tonight and for doing all of the work to make this possible, because it is an enormous amount of work. So thank you very much to the Free Library. I'm going to read a couple stories tonight, And I also want to thank the thousands of people who wrote to me over this past winter. And some of those letters were just extraordinary. So I'd like to read excerpts from three of those letters between the stories I read. And then somewhere during all of that, I'm going to ask for questions from you. When you ask a question, what you're going to get is you are going to get a copy of one of the funniest, sweetest, darkest books I have read in a long time, the small press novel Clown Girl by Monica Drake. It's from Hawthorne Press. It might be a little hard to find, but it's small press, and it is a fantastic book. And you are going to get a copy of Obscene Interiors, one of the dirtiest, funniest books I have seen in my adult life. So, Clown Girl and obscene interiors. And a wedding bouquet. So, let's test this. Who's got a question? How about the gentleman against the wall with the wristwatch?
No, here's this part.
Now, I saw an interview with you once. It might have been on Postcards from the Future. It was basically talking about satire of like Mary Shelley and Frankenstein, how it was kind of about industrialization. And I just finished a rant like maybe 2 hours ago. And I was trying to think of some of the different satire elements that you're using, if you used any purposely. But I mean, a couple I picked out maybe like have been a little obvious, but I was curious to see if you like purposely put any in there as like a outlook on our society today.
You know, in a way, rant, if on that kind of a sort of big level, is a satire of maybe Huckleberry Finn or Tom Sawyer or even Thoreau. We have this American archetype of the human being who is so present and in the moment, that sort of nature boy archetype. And so in a way, Rand Casey was that. And then there's a lot of just personal things that are sort of turned into metaphors, so I could put those on paper and get rid of them. But yeah, it really is my Huckleberry Finn. So, now that we know how that works, here's a letter, part of a letter from Shadow Hills, California. From Shadow Hills. I got a scholarship from Warner Brothers that came with a 4-year internship, and this was my first year. For 3 weeks, I was assigned to the mailroom, and every morning I was led to a pile of fan mail and given a big red return to sender stamp. I spent a good chunk of every day sending back Mel Gibson's hate mail, Jennifer Aniston's stalker letters, and the Olsen twins' marriage proposals. At first, I thought it was cute, but after that first week, I started getting exasperated. I wanted to yell at these people, "Brad Pitt is not getting the wedding present you sent him. Save your money. Brooke Shields will not get the sweater that you knitted for her. Ellen DeGeneres does not want to have lunch and hear your ideas for a new sitcom. And Steven Seagal doesn't even work here anymore. So stop sending these letters." But then I'd get letters from Taiwan, from little girls who adore, of all people, Ashley Simpson. And I'd feel bad. Because just like I'd love for you to read this letter, those little girls want to hear back from Ashley. So I started stealing the letters. Taking them home and writing back. I mean, Ashley Simpson is never going to know. Yui from Taiwan is never going to know. Everybody is happy, and I don't feel like a bitch for sending it back. I figure this way, if anything, this could improve my karma. So, another question. And I'm going to go, in this case, boy, girl, boy, girl. So, a girl question. Right there on the aisle with your knees up. Yeah.
So my question is, okay. How much were the droolers from Rant inspired by zombie movies?
Yeah. how much were the droolers in Rent inspired by zombie movies? Anybody see Land of the Dead with the fast-moving zombies that could, like, really run and then kill you? All my friends and I, whenever we're watching, like, The English Patient, we always say, you know what this movie could use right now? Fast-moving zombies. My Dinner with Andre, zombies. That needs lots of zombies. So, you know, zombies spice up pretty much everything. And also, I love the whole Jacques Derrida idea that the zombie personifies or is a great symbol for things that are unresolved. Is it dead? Is it alive? Is it an animal? Is it a human? And so these unresolved things just make us crazy. And so yeah, that was kind of my way to play with zombies. Just get some fast-moving zombies in there. And if you're not familiar with my work, it can go to some dark places. But I always hope that it's a trip worth making. So please just, you know, bear that in mind in regard to what I read tonight. You know, it may be a little dark on the surface, but it will get darker. And the first story I'd like to read is a completely unpublished story. It's a story that you'll pretty much only hear on tour. It's nowhere. And I wanted to bring you something that would be exclusive to thank you for making the effort for getting out. So, the story is called Cold Calling. Cold Calling. The computer that we got, it feeds me a Mrs. Wayne Timmons with a Battle Creek area code. It's the first week that we're cold calling for the Wonder Wet Wiper. Not just a mop, but a whole entire floor enhancement system. The only sure way for you to protect and preserve your fine quality floor coverings. An inexpensive way to save you thousands of dollars in ruined hardwood or costly vinyl laminate damage. All of that peace of mind for just three easy payments of. And Mrs. Wayne Timmons in Battle Creek says, "Hold up," she says. "Why should I buy anything from you?" It's our policy, says, to jump back to level 2 statements. Because the Wonder Wet Wiper will save you far more than its cost in time saved and eventual resale on your home. And Mrs. Wayne Timmons says, "Do you even believe in God?" It's not on the approved response script. But I answered. Dialogue outside of the established flowcharts. Officially, it's called a jog. Officially, we're not supposed to engage with off-track subject tangents, but I told her, "Yeah." And Mrs. Wayne Timmons says, "Our one true Christian God?" "Yeah." Officially, I'm supposed to redirect the topic back to the Wonder Wet Wiper, saying how it's so easy that cleaning her kitchen floor will no longer count as servile work on the Sabbath. And Mrs. Wayne Timmons, she says, "You don't believe in some smiling elephant god, do you?" She says, "Are you sure you don't worship some naked woman with a lot of wiggling arms?" The basics of any outbound call are you start with the greet, the grant, and the pitch. First, you say good evening or morning or whatever. That's the greet part. You ask for permission to speak with the customer. That's the grant part. Only then do you pitch. "What time is it there?" says Mrs. Wayne Timmons. It's 4 in the afternoon here, she says. It's 3 o'clock here, I say. Same afternoon. Another jog. Enough jogs and the training supervisor registers a demerit. Enough demerits and you'll be looking for an even worse paying job. And Mrs. Wayne Timmons says, don't lie to me about the time. She says, are you in Calcutta or New Delhi? India or Pakistan? Another jog. I'm in Walla Walla. I pray to her exact same God, the big old man with a white beard. And she says, what's your name? And I say, Bill. And she says, don't lie to me, Omar or Akbar. Mrs. Wayne Timmons says, we Americans know how you're trained. It's been in the newspapers and on the TV. You're given regular names and they teach you how to talk like a normal, real person. She says, but we still know that you're taking food out of the mouths of our sweet American babies. Across the networking floor, the training supervisor looks up from her desk, meets my eyes, her eyebrows sprung up. She points one fingernail at the digital readout on the wall, the calls in progress, the total calls per shift, and how my jogs are dragging out the average length per call. The 3-minute average is stretching to 4.5. The training supervisor drags a fingernail across her throat. In my headset, Mrs. Wayne Timmons says, you don't even eat hamburger. I've seen pictures, she says. You let dirty cows block traffic. My eyes. I'm watching the average call time stretch to 5 minutes. Associates at other desks, other banks, they're looking at me, shaking their heads at how I'm wrecking their monthly bonus. The script says that I should apologize and terminate, but I don't. I keep jogging, saying my name is William Bradley Henderson. I'm 17 years old, and I go to Thomas Jefferson High School in Walla Walla, Washington. I work 4 nights each week doing telephone sales to save up for a used car. And Mrs. Wayne Timmons says, you people don't miss a trick. And too loud, I say it into my mouthpiece. I say, trust me. All around me, headsets pop up. Eyes spin around to pin me from a million directions. Black associates, Hispanic and Asian associates, Native Americans. And into my phone I whisper, I mean I'm practically yelling, listen lady, I am just as white as you. My next night at work, a man with a Sioux Falls area code says, you people hijack our jetliners and crash them into our skyscrapers, and I'm supposed to buy your crappy mop? He says, well, no friggin' thanks, Haji. A man in the Tulsa area code says, towel head, and hangs up. A man in the Fargo area code says, camel jockey, and hangs up. In the Memphis area code, a man says, sand nigger. And the line goes dead. Next in the phone queue, the computer feeds me a West Los Angeles area code, and the woman who answers says, Tiananmen Square was a human rights tragedy, but you have to keep striving toward your freedom. She says, as a member of Amnesty International, I spend every extra penny in my fight to get a decent living wage and safe working conditions for your people. She says, you need to rise up and throw off the shackles of your imperialist corporate overlords. She says, be brave. But she doesn't buy the mop. Next in the phone queue, the computer feeds me a Mr. and Mrs. Wells in Washington State, area code 509, and some girl picks up. I say, may I talk to you about a revolution in floor maintenance? And this girl, she says, sure. She says, talk. The greet, the grant, the pitch. And interrupting me, this girl says, I envy you. She says, I'm trapped in this dinky town called Walla Walla. A whole tank full of gas from any place good. I go to school with clone kids, the same clothes and hair and dreams like we all came off the same assembly line. And I'm never getting out. Ever. I say how the Wonder Wet Wiper constitutes a whole entire floor enhancement system. And this girl, she says, do you have an elephant? She says, I mean, do you drive to work on a real alive elephant? The queue, the average call time, the floor supervisor. And I say, yeah. Breaking the script, I say, I got a 5-year-old Indian elephant. And she says, how cool is that? And I say, he's named Sinbad. And this girl says, I love that. She says, I have a cat. Really, she's an ocelot. I mean, she'll be an ocelot when she's fully grown, but her name is Pepper. The floor supervisor is looking, walking my way, maybe close enough to overhear. This girl says, my parents adopted me, she says, when I was a baby in Zaire, where my adopted dad was stationed in the Peace Corps. They're nice and everything, but it's just weird being the only African-American girl in like a whole place. She says, do you know what an ocelot is? And writing her phone number on my scratch paper, I asked this girl if maybe I can put her on our callback list for some other night so we can talk some more about the Wonder Wet Wiper. Yes, please, she says. She says, Samantha. I'm Samantha, but my birth name is Shamu Rindi. And I terminate the call. That week at school, I walk up to a black girl during lunch and I asked, are you from Zaire? And she just looked at me. She tossed her shoulder at me and she turned and walked away. Another day, I asked a black girl, did she have an ocelot? And she said, a what? I said, it's a little-sized wild cat. And she rolled her eyes, saying, I know what an ocelot is. Another day, I walked up to the last black girl at Thomas Jefferson High School, and I asked, is your real name Shamu Rindi? And this girl just looked at me for a long, long time, waiting. So I asked, Samantha Wells? And the girl lifted one hand slow and she pointed a fingernail at a girl across the lunchroom, a white girl with long blonde hair wearing a cheerleader outfit. On my call back, Samantha Shamu Rindi, she says, nobody likes the music I like, that kind of tribal, global, world beat, techno stuff. Or the organic, natural food that's the only kind I can eat. I mean, my taste is so beyond their limited experience. I don't say anything. A really good example, she says, is summertime. The humid weather we have, it makes my hair all nappy. I don't say anything. She says, how's your elephant? Good, I say. He's fine. Sinbad, she says, right? I ask if she wants to buy the Wonder wet wiper. And Samantha says, if I buy one, will you call me back again tomorrow? My next night at work, a man with a Yakima area code says, right this minute, he says, what I want to know is how come our taxpayers keep feeding you billions in financial aid and you never get any better. I mean, you're always getting AIDS or having a famine. The floor supervisor steps up beside my chair, shaking her head. She draws a finger across her throat, and I terminate the call. On another callback, Samantha says, I love the fact that you're East Indian. She says, that is so sexy. She says, or are you a Pakistani? I ask if she wants to buy a fifth Wonder wet wiper. And she says, wait while I sneak my dad's credit card. That next week at Thomas Jefferson High School, I walked up to the blonde cheerleader and I said, hey, I said, are you Samantha Wells? And she said, who's asking? Her voice, the same voices over the telephone, the girl with almost a dozen Wonder wet wipers, but no ocelot. Me, I'm the make-believe elephant boy. I say, would you like to go out sometime? And Samantha says, I'm kind of involved right now. She says, he doesn't go here. Fake whispering, leaning close in her cheerleader sweater, her blonde hair ponytail down her back, she says, he's a Hindu. She says, we have this romantic long-distance thing. I say, what's his name? I never told her my name. And shaking her head, Samantha says, you wouldn't know him. So I ask. I say, how can she date somebody who doesn't believe in our one true Christian God? Standing here, my hair and my clothes and my dreams, everything about me coming off the same assembly line as her, me just another Thomas Jefferson clone, I say, all those Hindus, I say, Hindus are fags. And she shrugs. Samantha shrugs and she says, sorry. And she turns her ponytail swinging and she walks away. And after her, I'm yelling that she's white. She's a white girl of the white race and she needs to be dating white Christian guys, not hooking up with some colored homo halfway around the world, making godless, half-breed, devil-worshipping babies. I yell after her, I'm Bill. My name is Bill Henderson. Only by now, Samantha Wells, she is pretty much all the way gone. That's cold calling. Girl, boy.
The gentleman in the flat shirt?
All right.
Yes, sir. Did you catch all the way?
Yeah.
Thank you. I was wondering what the difference in writing is now as a professional writer who can clearly do it for a living, and how that compared to the beginning of your career when you had to work jobs and kind of write in bursts and you couldn't concentrate full-time on a book. How does that differ?
It doesn't really differ a whole lot. You know, I think that my work now that I can really devote a lot of time to it has a cohesiveness that it didn't have. Fight Club has so many single sentence paras in it because my goal was, if I can get a sentence every day, then beyond paying the bills and doing my job and wearing clean clothes, that's enough. And so that's why, you know, those single sentence paras, that's the work of one day. That's the only part of my day when my boss looked away long enough for me to write something down. And now I can really focus on, you know, making sort of a more sort of even narrative that's not quite so choppy. But my process is still entirely the same, which is mostly to spend a lot of my time taking notes and listening to stories and then Monday morning frantically hammer it into the computer so I can take it to workshop on Monday nights. So really, you know, that's the only way that my process has changed. Girl.
I guess I just wanted to ask, I'm sorry, my voice is like ridiculous right now. You talk about like the dark side of your books a lot. And I think that like something about your writing that has always inspired me is that it has this layer of like, there's a lot of like nihilism and things like that on the surface. But I think something I always got out of it was that in the end, it's like your characters show like the human side of people, the fact that we're flawed and things like that. But that, in the face of that, there can still be beauty in the world. And I guess I think that, like, is that something you think you're putting into your writing? Like, is that something you hope to inspire in people? Like, that there is still hope, that there are, like, that there is still a way of, like, sort of taking, like, the bizarre, completely surreal aspect of life and, like, finding the humor in it and things like that.
That's a really good question because it's a little frustrating when I see the word sociopathic applied to me, or nihilist, or fascist, all these words I can't even spell. Because what makes me remember a story is, here's a story. And it typically starts this way. My first day at Freightliner on the assembly line, which was my first big job out of college with all the other journalism majors, my foreman, Dan, told me to go up to the finish cab line of this massive Freightliner truck manufacturing plant. And Dan said, get our squeegee sharpener back because they borrowed our sharpener a long time ago and they never got it back to us. And don't take no for an answer, because if you come back empty-handed, you are out of here. So I go up to finish cab, and I say, well, Dan says you got our sharpener, and we really need it back. And they said, no. They said, you stupid fuck. That was our sharpener, and Dan borrowed it from us. And if, you know, if you really want it back so bad, you know, Axel Buildup borrowed it from us, so go to Axel Buildup and go begging for it. And I go to Axel Buildup, and they tear me a new asshole. And they send me to pre-paint cab. And they send me to rough cab buildup. And they send me to engine hanging. And they send me to Axel installation. And I get sent all over the plant. And every guy in this massive plant tears me a new asshole and calls me every obscene name in the book. And I still have to go back to my foreman empty-handed. And there is no such thing as a squeegee sharpener. But I learned the entire plant. I learned every workstation, every department of the plant, and I basically introduced myself to everybody at the plant. And I lived through a ritual that they had all lived through. And I told that story, and a man came up and he said, your first day in a TV station, they have these things called gels, which are pieces of colored cellophane that are typically put in front of a spotlight to color the light. And the gels now, they're made out of a thick colored cellophane material. But they're called gels because they used to be made out of thin, thin sheets of hardened gelatin, basically colored jello that is dried and thin. And every TV station has a few of these really old gels left. And on your first day, they give you a few, and your boss says, okay, here's an easy job. You can't fuck this up. Here's some gels. I need you to wash the gels. And don't scratch them, because these are worth more than you make in a year. And if you fuck these up, you're out of here, because we don't need you. And you got to use the coldest water that will come out of the tap, because if you use water with any warmth, it will warp the gel. So just do it, okay? And don't mess it up. And they're gelatin, so when you take them in there and you let the water run for a long time until it's cold, the moment even a drop of water touches this, it dissolves to colored water. It's gone. And the colored water goes down the drain, and that's it. And you're left shitting your pants. And you spend the rest of the day avoiding the guy who gave you that job. And I told that story to a friend of mine who's a pediatrician. And he said, when you're a resident at the teaching hospital in Portland, the Oregon Health Sciences University, they wait till you've been on call for 36 hours. And they wait for you to lay down on a gurney in a hallway to catch a 10-minute nap. And you haven't eaten anything but candy bars in 36 hours. And you are so sleep-deprived and delirious. And the moment you drift off to sleep, they announce, Dr. Such-and-such, code red to room such-and-such, stat. And they just announce your name over and over. And you run through the hospital in the middle of the night, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, until you get to this wing that isn't really used very often. And you don't think about this, because as you burst out of the elevator, down the hall, you can already hear a woman screaming, just screaming. And as you run down the hallway and you throw that door open, the room is draped kind of nightmarishly with a lot of folding fabric screens and curtains pulled. And the lights are down near the floor, so it's sort of monster lighting down low with harsh shadows. And you don't really think about that. You don't notice this, because as you throw that door open, there's a woman laying in bed naked, covered in blood, and she's screaming. And as you throw that door open, something hits you in the chest, and you instinctively catch it. You grab it. And it's a dead, naked baby covered in blood. And this woman in bed is screaming, "You killed it, you fucker! You bastard, you killed my baby!" And the room is draped so nightmarishly because every doctor on staff is hiding in that room. And as much of the nursing staff as they can fit in that tiny little room, and the woman in bed is a nurse, and that baby feels so real because it's a recessive baby, one of those CPR babies. I told that story in France this last fall. And a man, a Frenchman, said, I'm a veterinarian. And to get into the academy in Paris to become a veterinarian is so incredibly competitive. It took me 2 or 3 years of applying before I was finally admitted to my program. And to be accepted, to celebrate the acceptance, your peers, your advisors, they throw you a party and they get you really drunk. And if you don't pass out, they put something in your drink so you do pass out. And they take all your clothes off and they bunch you up really tight and they sew you very methodically into the belly of a dead horse. And you wake up, he said. He said, you wake up inside this cold, sticky, tight, dark place. And it's stuffy. There's very little air. And it's kind of stretchy and bony. And you have no idea. And you're also fantastically hungover. And they're still having the party around you. So you hear all these drunk French people going, do it, you can do it, come out, join us. Come on, you can do it. Join us, be one with us. And so you have to, not knowing even what you're fighting your way out of, you have to birth yourself. And you squeeze out, and you are naked, and you are cold, and you are covered in blood. And as soon as you come out, they give you a drink, and they say, welcome to the program. And what I find so touching about all those stories is, in a way, they bond people with a worst-case scenario. No matter how shitty your day is, it's better than being sewn inside a dead horse. So typically I find even the most seemingly appalling things have a kind of, you know, basic human emotional need to them. And that's what I'm always trying to, you know, sort of point out. So thank you for that question. Boy question. Gentleman with a hat and the tattoos on your arms with the red thing. See, hats work.
Thanks. I was wondering, when you start to write a book, is it more of an organic process, or do you first get the idea, and then you develop an outline, or is it more of an organic process?
Starting a book, that's still the process I've always used. I come up with one premise. What about... Oh, a kid told me a great story about taking acid. And he went to a taping of The Price is Right. And he got called up. And he is... He is fried out of his mind. And there's these big showgirls, just big, monstrous showgirls wearing all this makeup, walking around in high heels. And there's this Bob Barker that just looks like this wrinkled thing hanging there. And they're spinning these colored lights, and everybody's excited about Rice-A-Roni. And they're asking him questions about the price of raisins. And so, typically, I hear a story like that, and so I'll write a short story based on that premise to see what I can do with it. And I'll take that short story into workshop just to see how people react to the premise. And you all reacted really nice. So, It's one of those stories that people just get. So, in the way that a painter will do figure studies to get really, really clear about different aspects of a large painting, I will do these seemingly unrelated short stories that each present a premise, maybe a key plot point, maybe a character's sort of the cute meat, something about each character, and I'll present them in workshop. And the sweet thing is that they stand alone, so that especially when you're working full-time, you have this ongoing sense of completing something week to week. You don't have to balance the entire equation forever and ever in your head. And you can sell the story separately. You can get them in magazines beforehand. And eventually, if you have to tour, you've got these sweet little standalone things. And so my process is really to do these stories, these little tests, test them on my workshop. And in a way, workshop will suggest where the stories sort of meet and connect in thematic ways I hadn't recognized. And they'll also suggest where these stories can go. And so that really is my process, is to start with several things that I find very, very compelling and then just sort of grow from there until they all connect. So I'm going to read one more letter from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. From Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My family really can't afford to have me stay an extra semester, and I am extremely loath to take out any loans to help, because I know I'd be paying them off for the rest of my life. In terms of creative endeavors, though, I am working on a project that I'm really excited about, Night of the Living Dead, the musical. The best part about the concept in general is that the original Night was never properly copyrighted, and the script and film are now in public domain. So much of it is already in place. I have a friend who is amazing at writing schlocky, overdramatic music that's absolutely perfect for the tone of the film. I'm spending all of this school year in intense pre-production. I'm starting work on this script very soon, and half the songs have already been written. Most of the cast is already in place, and I'll be casting for dancers soon. I can already tell that shooting it next year will be the most exciting thing that I have ever done. See how smart people are? I love that. Boy question, girl question.
Girl question. Please, on the
aisle. Whenever you watch the news and hear these stories, do you tend to rewrite them in your head, that thinking this is how it's supposed to be or this is how it's supposed to end?
I don't watch the news. The very, very first time I ever went to the agency in New York that eventually handled my work, they said, we're probably not supposed to do this. It's not really ethical. But then they went into another room and they brought out this enormous stack. And they said, this is 1 week's unsolicited manuscripts from people seeking agents. And it was like 175 full manuscripts. And they said, remember the Covenant House scandal, the priests molesting the boys? 100 of these are about priests molesting boys. And they showed me how whenever something happened in the news, about 6 months later, they would get a tidal wave of novels about fictionalized Terry Schiavo's. And so many people were really trying to hit, you know, bring something to market in response, in reaction to what was in the news. And you can't do that because it takes at least a year from manuscript to book. And so you just cannot write in reaction to the way the world is. You have to write sort of in anticipation. You have to, in a way, lead rather than follow with the news. So I really, you know, I haven't had TV since 91. And no, I'm not a news person. And also, I have no idea where these stories are going to go. Because that's the big joy, is that you maybe have a little machine, and you know that if somebody pretends to choke in public and fools people into loving him because they think they've saved his life, eventually two of these people will speak to each other and the entire illusion, the entire circle of this fake love will be destroyed. So you can create these little buried guns or these little self-destructing machines, and those will get you into the second act. Sometimes that disaster will make a really good second act. Breakfast at Tiffany's. You kind of know that as soon as she's seeing Sally Tomato in prison, that is what Truman Capote is going to use to sort of bring things to a crisis in the second act. And anymore, it's really easy to see the buried gun in the first act, the thing that's going to be brought up to bring things to a crisis. So you maybe know what that buried gun is, but the joy is writing that third act beyond what you know, because you actually have to sort of be a different person. You have to evolve as a person and write something that you could not have written or could not have anticipated. And that joy of surviving yourself, that joy of surprising yourself is just, it's intoxicating. You know, when I walked around the house going, oh, fuck, Tyler and Jack are the same person. It's such a rush. That is really, really the reward. And it feels so good. At that point, you really don't care whether or not you sell the thing. So I had planned to do a short presentation this evening, because I thought that we'd be reading together. And since that's not the case, they've said I can go slightly longer. And what I'd like to do is, since I've never read this in Philly, I was thinking about reading Guts. Yes. Is that okay? So please be responsible for your own well-being. And this is a short story I wrote, and I took to workshop, and my workshop just loved. They laughed like crazy. So, Guts. Inhale. Breathe really deep. Take in as much air as you possibly can. This story should last about as long as you can hold your breath, and then just a little bit longer, so listen as fast as you can. A friend of mine, when he was 13 years old, he heard all about pegging. Pegging is when a guy gets banged up the butt with a dildo. You stimulate the prostate gland hard enough, and the rumor is that you can have explosive hands-free orgasms. At that age, at 13, this friend's a little sex maniac. He's always jonesing for a better way to get his rocks off. So he goes out to buy a carrot and some petroleum jelly to conduct a little private research. Then he pictures how it's going to look at the supermarket check stand. that lonely carrot and the petroleum jelly rolling down the conveyor belt toward the grocery store cashier, all the other shoppers waiting in line watching, everybody seeing the big evening he has planned. So my friend, he goes and he buys milk and eggs and sugar and a carrot, all the ingredients for a carrot cake, and Vaseline. Like he's going to go home and stick a carrot cake up his butt. At home, he whittles the carrot into a blunt little tool. He slathers it with the grease and he grinds his ass down on it. Then nothing, no orgasm, nothing happens except this hurts like hell. Then this kid, his mom yells, "It's supper time." She says to come downstairs right now. So he works the carrot out and he stashes this slippery, filthy thing in the dirty clothes under his bed. After dinner, he goes to find the carrot, but it's gone. All of his dirty clothes, while he was eating dinner, his mom grabbed them to do the laundry. No way could she not find the carrot, carefully shaped with a paring knife from her kitchen, still shiny with lube and stinky. This friend of mine, he waits months under a black cloud, waiting for his folks to confront him, and they never do, ever. Even now that he's grown up, that invisible carrot hangs over every Christmas dinner, every birthday party, every Easter egg hunt with his kids, now his parents' grandkids. That ghost carrot is hovering over all of them. That's something too awful to name. People in France, they have a phrase, spirit of the stairway. In French, they say, esprit de escalier. It means that moment when you find the answer, but it's just too late. Say you're at a party and somebody insults you. You have to say something. So under pressure, with everybody watching, you say something lame. But the moment you leave the party, as you start down the stairway, then magic. You come up with the perfect thing you should have said, that perfect crippling put down. That is spirit of the stairway. The trouble is, even the French don't have a phrase for the stupid things you actually do say under pressure. Those stupid, desperate things you actually think or that you do. Some deeds are just too low to even get a name, too low to ever get talked about. Looking back now, kids' psych experts, school counselors, they now say that most of the last peak in teen suicide was kids trying to choke while they beat off. Their folks would find them a towel twisted around their kid's neck, the towel tied to the rod in their bedroom closet, their kid dead, dead sperm everywhere. Of course their folks cleaned up. They put some pants on their kid. They made it look better, intentional at least. Just the regular sad kind of teen suicide. Another friend of mine, a kid from school. His older brother in the Navy said how guys in the Middle East, they jack off different than we do here. This brother was stationed in some camel country where the public market sells what could be fancy letter openers. Each fancy tool is just a thin rod of polished brass or silver, maybe as long as your hand, but with a big tip at one end, either a big metal ball or the kind of fancy carved handle that you'd see on a sword. This Navy brother says how Arab guys, They get their dick hard, and then they insert this metal rod inside the whole length of their boner. They jack off with the rod inside, and it makes getting off so much better, more intense. It's this big brother who travels around the world sending back French phrases, Russian phrases, helpful jack-off tips. It's after this, the little brother, one day he doesn't show up at school. That night he calls to ask if I'll pick up his homework for the next couple weeks because he's in the hospital. He's got to share a room with old people getting their guts worked on. He says how they all have to share the same television. All he's got for privacy is a curtain. His folks don't come to visit. On the phone, he says how right now his folks could just kill his big brother in the Navy. On the phone, the kid says how the day before he was just a little bit stoned. At home in his bedroom, he was flopped on the bed. He was lighting a candle and flipping through some old porno magazines, getting ready to beat off. This is after he's heard from his Navy brother that helpful hint about how Arabs beat off. The kid looks around for something that might do the job. A ballpoint pen is too big. A pencil is too big and too rough, but dripped down the side of the candle, there's a thin, smooth ridge of wax that just might work. With just the tip of one finger, this kid snaps the long ridge of wax off the candle. He rolls it smooth between the palms of his hands, long and smooth and thin, stoned and horny. He slips this down inside, deeper and deeper into the piss slit of his boner. With a good hank of the wax still poking out the top, he gets to work. Even now, he says, those Arab guys are pretty damn smart. They have totally reinvented jacking off. Flat on his back in bed, things are getting so good, this kid can't keep track of the wax. He is one good squeeze from shooting his wad when the wax isn't sticking out anymore. This thin wax rod, it slipped inside, all the way inside. So deep inside that he can't even feel the lump of it inside of his piss tube. From downstairs, his mom shouts, it's supper time. She says to come down right now. This wax kid and the carrot kid, they are different people, but we all live pretty much the same life. It's after dinner when the kid's guts start to hurt. It's wax, so he figured it would just melt inside of him and he could just piss it out. But now his back hurts, his kidneys, he can't even stand up straight. This kid talking on the phone from his hospital bed in the background, you can hear bells ding, people screaming, game shows. The x-rays showed the truth. Something long and thin bent double inside of his bladder. This long, thin V inside of him. It's collecting all the minerals in his piss. It's getting bigger and more rough. Coated with crystals of calcium, it's bumping around, ripping up the soft lining of his bladder, blocking his piss from getting out. His kidneys are backed up. What little that does leak out of his dick is red with blood. This kid and his folks, his whole damn family, them looking at the black x-ray with the doctors and the nurses standing there. That big V of wax glowing bright white for everybody to see. He has to tell the truth. The way Arabs get off. What his big brother wrote him from the Navy. On the phone right now, he starts to cry. They paid for the bladder operation with his college fund. One stupid mistake, and now he'll never be a lawyer. Sticking stuff inside yourself. Sticking yourself inside of stuff. A candle in your dick or your head in a noose. We all knew this was gonna be big trouble. What got me in trouble? They used to call it pearl diving. This meant whacking off underwater, sitting on the bottom at the deep end of my parents' swimming pool. With one deep breath, I'd kick my way to the bottom and I'd slip off my swim trunks. I'd sit down there for 2, 3, 4 minutes. Just from jacking off, I had huge lung capacity. If I had the house to myself, I could do this all afternoon. After I'd finally pump out my stuff, my sperm, it would hang there in big, fat, milky gobs. After that was just more diving to collect it all, to catch it and to wipe each handful in a towel. That's why it was called pearl diving. Even with chlorine, there was still my sister to worry about. Or Christ Almighty, my mom. That used to be my worst fear in the whole world. My teenage virgin sister thinking she's just getting fat and then giving birth to a two-headed retard baby. Both the heads looking like me. Me, the father and the uncle. Still, in the end, it's never what you worry about that actually gets you. The best part of pearl diving was the inlet port for the swimming pool filter and the circulation pump. The best part was getting naked and sitting on it. As the French would say, who doesn't like getting their butt sucked? Still 1 minute you're just a kid getting off, and the next minute you'll never be a lawyer. 1 minute I am settling on the pool bottom and the sky is wavy light blue through 8 feet of water above my head. The world is silent except for the heartbeat in my ears. My yellow striped swim trunks are looped around my neck for safekeeping, just in case a friend, a neighbor, anybody shows up to ask why I skipped football practice. The steady suck of the pool inlet hole is lapping at me, and I'm grinding my skinny white ass around on that feeling. 1 minute I've got enough air and my dick's in my hand. My folks are gone at their work and my sister's got ballet. Nobody's supposed to be home for hours. My hand brings me right to getting off, and I stop. I swim up to catch another big breath. I dive down and settle on the bottom. I do this again and again. This must be why girls want to sit on your face. The suction, it's like taking a dump that never ends. With my dick hard and getting my butt eaten out, I do not need air. My heartbeat in my ears, I stay under until bright stars of light start worming around in my eyes, my legs straight out, the back of each knee rubbed raw against the concrete bottom. My toes are turning blue, my toes and fingers wrinkled from being so long in the water. And then I let it happen. The big white gob starts spouting the pearls. It's then I need some air. But when I go to kick off against the bottom, I can't. I can't get my feet underneath me. My ass is stuck. Emergency paramedics will tell you that every year about 150 people get stuck this way, sucked by a circulation pump. You get your long hair caught, or your ass, and you are going to drown. Every year, tons of people do, most of them in Florida. People just do not talk about this. Not even French people talk about everything. Getting one knee up, getting one foot tucked under me, I get to half standing when I feel the tug against my butt. Getting my other foot under me, I kick off against the bottom. I'm kicking free, not touching the concrete, but not getting to the air either. Still kicking water, thrashing with both arms. I'm maybe halfway to the surface, but I'm not getting any higher. The heartbeat inside my head is getting loud and fast. The bright sparks of light are crossing and crisscrossing my eyes. I turn and I look back, but it doesn't make sense. This thick kind of rope, some kind of snake, blue, white, and braided with veins that's come up out of the pool drain, and it's holding on to my butt. Some of the veins are leaking blood, red blood that looks black underwater and drifts away from little rips in the pale skin of the snake. The blood trails away, disappearing in the water. And inside the snake's thin, blue-white skin, you can see lumps of some half-digested meal. That's the only way this makes sense. Some horrible sea monster. A sea serpent. Something that's never seen the light of day. It's been hiding in the dark bottom of our swimming pool drain, waiting to eat me. So I kick at it. I kick at the slippery, rubbery, knotted skin and veins of it, and more of it seems to pull up out of the pool drain. It's maybe as long as my leg now, but still holding tight around my butthole. With another kick, I'm an inch closer to getting another breath. Still feeling the snake tug at my ass, I'm an inch closer to my escape. Knotted deep inside the snake, you can see corn and peanuts. You can see a long, bright orange ball. It's that kind of horse pill vitamin my dad makes me take to help me put on weight to get a football scholarship with extra iron and omega-3 fatty acids. It's seeing that vitamin pill that saves my life. It's not a snake. It's my large intestine. My colon pulled out of me, what doctors would call prolapsed. It's my gut sucked into the drain. Paramedics will tell you that a swimming pool pump pulls 80 gallons of water every minute. That's about 400 pounds of pressure. The big problem is we're all connected together inside. Your ass is just the far end of your mouth. If I let go, the pump keeps working, keeps unraveling my insides until it's got my tongue. Imagine
taking a 400-pound shit, and you can see how this just might turn you inside out. What I can tell you is your guts don't feel much pain, not the way your skin feels pain. The stuff you're digesting, doctors call it fecal matter. Higher up is chyme, pockets of thin, runny mess studded with corn and peanuts and round green peas. That's all this soup of blood and corn shit and sperm and peanuts floating around me. Even with my guts unraveling out of my ass, me holding on to what's left, even then, my first want is to somehow get my swimsuit back on. God forbid my folks see my dick. My one hand holding a fist around my ass, my other hand snags my yellow striped swim trunks and pulls them from around my neck. Still getting back into them is impossible. You want to feel your intestines? Go buy a pack of those lambskin condoms, take one out and unroll it, pack it with peanut butter, smear it with petroleum jelly, and hold it underwater. Then try to tear it. Just try to pull it in half. It is just too tough and rubbery. It is so slimy, you cannot hold on. A lambskin condom, that's just plain old intestine. Now, maybe you can see what I'm up against. You let go for a second, and you're gutted. You swim for the surface for a breath, and you're gutted. You don't swim, and you drown. This is a choice between being dead right now or 1 minute from right now. What my folks are going to find after work is a big naked fetus curled in on itself, floating in the cloudy water of their backyard swimming pool, tethered to the bottom by a thick rope of veins and twisted guts, the opposite of a kid hanging himself to death while he jacks off. This is the baby they brought home from the hospital 13 years ago. Here is the kid that they hoped would snag a football scholarship and get an MBA, who would take care of them in their old age. Here's all their hopes and dreams floating here, naked and dead, all around him big milky pearls of wasted sperm. It's either that or my folks will find me wrapped in a bloody towel, collapsed halfway between the pool and the kitchen telephone, the ragged, torn scrap of my guts still hanging out, one leg of my yellow striped swim trunks. What even the French won't talk about. That big brother in the Navy, he taught us one other good phrase, a Russian phrase. The way that we say, I need that like I need a hole in my head. Russian people, they say, I need that like I need teeth in my asshole. Нет, это надо как забиваться. Those stories you hear about how animals caught in a trap will chew off their leg? Well, any coyote will tell you that a couple bites beats the hell out of being dead. Even if you're Russian, someday you just might want to have those teeth. Otherwise, what you got to do is you have to twist around. You hook one elbow behind your knee and you pull that leg up into your face. You bite and snap at your own ass. You run out of air and you will chew through anything to get that next breath. This is not something you want to tell a girl on the first date. Not if you expect a kiss goodnight. If I told you how it tasted, you would never, ever again eat calamari. It is, it's really, really hard to say what my folks were more disgusted by, how I got myself into trouble or how I saved myself. After the hospital, my mom just said, "You didn't know what you were doing, honey. You were in shock." And she learned how to cook poached eggs.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.